welcome to Food Stuff. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And this is a very special episode of Food Stuff.
Aren't all episodes of Food Stuff special?
Aw, you're like my mom.
No, it is though, because today we're gonna tell you a story. We're gonna read you a story dramatically. I mean, we always do that.
We do. we're off to a bad start. No, we're okay. So we had this idea to do kind of a mini series or a recurring segment.
Sure.
But we wanted to tell some foodstuff fairy tales. We wanted to read them in a hopefully enjoyable, semi-dramatic fashion and then discuss.
Yeah, because one of the really pervasive elements of fairy tales and fantasy stories is food. You know, from like those lavish descriptions of feasts in like George R. R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire to specific foods that are used symbolically in fables, like Aesop's hypothetically sour grapes, yeah, to the hunger that's often portrayed in fairy tales like in Hansel and Gretel. So we wanted to discuss that a bit and, yeah, also do for you a dramatic reading of one such tale.
Mm-hmm. We are going to come back and do more if you guys dig it, and I think that you will. I hope that you will. But just today, we're not. There are so many fairy tales that involve people, usually women or children, getting eaten, chopped up, eaten and cooked. Yeah, there's a lot of those.
Yeah. We're going to save those for like a Halloween
situation,
we think.
Yeah, I think so.
So, yeah, cannibalism, separate issue.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, we've heard all of your requests for an episode about cannibalism.
We have. For people that are like, what? We have a surprising number of requests for an episode about cannibalism. So noted. And I, like, just thinking about this, I realized how many things I wouldn't even necessarily think of right away. Like Snow White has the poisonous apple, where you've got Alice in Wonderland with all kinds of things happening there.
Oh, yeah. And like holy heck, will I ever get in on reading some Alice's Adventures in Wonderland and or Through the Looking Glass? Because, like, that is, A, just terrific, and B, in the public domain.
Yes. Okay, so that is one thing that we are limited by. Has to be in the public domain, then translation has to be in the public domain.
Yes. And actually, our first reading selection is by an author who was later influenced by Lewis Carroll and Alice's Adventures. Yes, to kick off this new periodic foodstuff series, we wanted to read for you and talk about the poem Goblin Market by Christina Georgina Rossetti.
Mm-hmm. It's a 3,000-odd-word poem composed around 1861 and published by Macmillan in 1862 in Rossetti's first commercially published book of poetry.
Rossetti is considered one of the premier woman poets of her time, like right behind Elizabeth Barrett Browning. She's said to have been like a very proprietous, particular, and religious woman, though as a child she had a reputation for having a really stormy temper. She was affiliated with an Anglo-Catholic church in England and volunteered extensively for the St. Mary Magdalene Penitentiary, an organization that worked with fallen women.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That might be a recurring theme in what we're about to read.
Indeed. She later refused to get on board with women's suffrage, saying that she believed that, quote, the highest functions are not in this world open to both sexes. But she also said that, like, really, if the movement wanted to get in and change things, they'd have to go ahead and get female representatives in Parliament. So, interesting perspective there. Like, don't give us the vote, just get us straight into Parliament.
Yeah. Huh.
She was critical of slavery and imperialism and petitioned to raise the age of consent. She never married, but did remain close to her family, and particularly her artist and writer brother, Dante Gabriel, who supported her financially and professionally. She dealt with various bouts of severe illness all her life, and depression that historians can't really agree on whether was the result or at times the cause of those illnesses. She was writing in a time that the pre-Raphaelite artistic movement was really flourishing, but she didn't overly associate herself with it. But her work does bear a lot of the same influences and hallmarks of it, like all of this sort of medieval mythology reimagined through these very Victorian sensibilities about, like, good and evil, purity, sin, what gender is, love, sex, you know, the pursuit of earthly pleasures.
Mm-hmm.
And we picked Goblin Market for our first reading because it's about food and temptation and indulgence. And it's just real weird and real pretty.
Yeah. We recruited Robert Lamb and Joe McCormick, our colleagues over at Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
Yes.
To help us read this. And there was definitely moments when we were reading it and we were all looking at each other like, whoa.
I think I started blushing a few times. I was like, oh my goodness. The poem was actually rejected, like soundly, by the first art critic who read it, one John Ruskin. He praised its beauty and power, but said that it was unpublishably full of quaintness and offenses.
Ooh.
He also criticized the irregular meter that is now basically celebrated for and said, she should exercise herself in the severest commonplace of meter until she can write as the public like.
The severest commonplace?
Yeah.
Oof. That's a burn right there.
It super is.
Mm-hmm. Also, thanks to listener Caroline for recommending. She sent this to us forever ago.
Yeah. It's great. And Joe McCormick and Robert Lamb are great. And I guess we're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And then when we get back, we're going to get into it. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. And without further ado, we present to you Goblin Market by Christina Rossetti.
Morning and evening, maids heard the goblins cry.
Come buy our orchard fruits. Come buy, come buy. Apples and quinces, lemons and oranges, plump unpecked cherries, melons and raspberries, bloom down-cheeked peaches, swart-headed mulberries, wild freeborn cranberries, crab apples, dewberries, pineapples, blackberries, apricots, strawberries, all ripe together in summer weather. Morns that pass by, fair eves that fly, come by, come by. Our grapes fresh from the vine, pomegranates full and fine, dates and sharp bullaces, rare pears and greengages, damsons and bilberries, taste them and try, currants and gooseberries, bright fire-like barberries, figs to fill your mouth, citrons from the south, sweet to tongue and sound to eye, come by, come by.
Evening by evening, among the brookside rushes, Laura bowed her head to hear, Lizzie veiled her blushes. Crouching close together in the cooling weather, with clasping arms and cautioning lips, with tingling cheeks and fingertips.
Lie close,
Laura said, pricking up her golden head.
We must not look at goblin men. We must not buy their fruits. Who knows upon what soil they fed their hungry, thirsty roots?
Come by,
called the goblins, hobbling down the glen.
Oh,
cried Lizzie.
Laura, Laura, you should not peep at the goblin men.
Lizzie covered up her eyes, covered close lest they should look. Laura reared her glossy head and whispered like the restless brook.
Look, Lizzie, down the glen tramp little men. One hauls a basket, one bears a plate, one lugs a golden dish of many pounds weight. How fair the vine must grow, whose grapes are so luscious. How warm the wind must blow through those fruit bushes.
No,
said Lizzie.
No, no, no. Their offers should not charm us. Their evil gifts would harm us.
She thrust a dimpled finger in each ear, shut eyes and ran. Curious Laura chose to linger, wondering at each merchant man. One had a cat's face. One whisked a tail. One tramped at a rat's pace. One crawled like a snail. One like a wombat prowled obtuse and furry. One like a radle tumbled hurry-scurry. She heard a voice like voice of doves cooing all together. They sounded kind and full of loves in the pleasant weather. Laura stretched her gleaming neck like a rush-embedded swan, like a lily from the beck, like a moonlit poplar branch, like a vessel at the launch when its last restraint is gone. Backwards up the mossy glen turned and trooped the goblin men with their shrill, repeated cry,
come by, come by.
When they reached where Laura was, they stood stock still upon the moss, leering at each other, brother with queer brother, signaling each other, brother with sly brother. One set his basket down, one reared his plate, one began to weave a crown of tendrils, leaves, and rough nuts brown. Men sell not such in any town. One heaved the golden weight of dish and fruit to offer her.
Come by, come by,
was still their cry. Laura stared but did not stir, longed but had no money. The whisk-tailed merchant bade her taste in tones as smooth as honey. The cat-faced purred, the rat-faced spoke a word of welcome, and the snail-paced even was heard. One parrot-voiced and jolly cried,
Pretty goblin,
still for
Pretty Polly.
One whistled like a bird. But sweet-tooth Laura spoke in haste.
Good folk, I have no coin to take or to purloin. I have no copper in my purse, I have no silver either, and all my gold is on the furs that shakes in windy weather above the rusty heather.
You have much gold upon your head,
they answered all together.
Buy from us with a golden curl.
She clipped a precious golden lock. She dropped a tear more rare than pearl, then sucked their fruit globes fair or red, sweeter than honey from the rock, stronger than man-rejoicing wine, clearer than water flowed that juice. She never tasted such before. How should it cloy with length of use? She sucked and sucked and sucked the more fruits which the unknown orchard bore. She sucked until her lips were sore, then flung the emptied rinds away, but gathered up one kernel stone, and knew not was it night or day, as she turned home alone. Lizzie met her at the gate, full of wise upbraidings.
Dear, you should not stay so late. Twilight is not good for maidens. Should not loiter in the glen, in the haunts of goblin men. Do you not remember Jeannie, how she met them in the moonlight, took their gifts both choice and many, ate their fruits and wore their flowers, plucked from bowers where summer ripens at all hours? But ever in the noonlight she pined and pined away, sought them by night and day, found them no more but dwindled and grew gray, then fell with the first snow, while to this day no grass will grow. Where she lies low, I planted daisies there a year ago. That never blow, you should not loiter so.
Nay, hush,
said Laura.
Nay, hush, my sister. I ate and ate my fill, yet my mouth waters still. Tomorrow night I will buy more.
And kissed her.
Have done with sorrow. I'll bring you plums tomorrow, fresh on their mother twigs, cherries worth getting. You cannot think what figs my teeth have met in, what melons icy cold, piled on a dish of gold, too huge for me to hold, what peaches with a velvet nap, pellucid grapes without one seed. Odorous indeed must be the mead whereon they grow, and pure the wave they drink with lilies at the brink, and sugar sweet their sap.
Golden head by golden head, like two pigeons in one nest, folded in each other's wings, they lay down in their curtained bed, like two blossoms on one stem, like two flakes of new-fallen snow, like two wands of ivory tipped with gold for awful kings. Moon and stars gazed in at them, wind sang to them lullaby, lumbering owls forbore to fly. Not a bat flapped to and fro round their rest, cheek to cheek and breast to breast, locked together in one nest. Early in the morning, when the first cock crowed his warning, neat like bees, as sweet and busy, Laura rose with Lizzie, fetched in honey, milked the cows, aired and set to rights the house, kneaded cakes of whitest wheat, cakes for dainty mouths to eat. Next churned butter, whipped up cream, fed their poultry, sat and sewed, talked as modest maidens should, Lizzie with an open heart, Laura in an absent dream. One content, one sick in part, one warbling for the mere bright day's delight, one longing for the night. At length slow evening came. They went with pitchers to the reedy brook, Lizzie most placid in her look, Laura most like a leaping flame. They drew the gurgling water from its deep. Lizzie plucked purple and rich golden flags, then turning homeward said,
The sunset flushes, those furthest, loftiest crags. Come, Laura, not another maiden lags. No willful squirrel wags. The beast and birds are fast asleep.
But Laura loitered still among the rushes, and said the bank was steep, and said the hour was early still, the dew not fallen, the wind not chill, listening ever but not catching the customary cry,
Come by, come by,
with its iterated jingle of sugar-baited words, Not for all her watching, once discerning even one goblin racing, whisking, tumbling, hobbling, let alone the herds that used to tramp along the glen in groups or single of brisk fruit merchant men. Till Lizzie urged,
"Oh, Laura, come. I hear the fruit call, but I dare not look. You should not loiter longer at this brook. Come with me home. The stars rise, the moon bends her arc. Each glowworm winks her spark. Let us get home before the night grows dark, for clouds may gather. Though this is summer weather, put out the lights and drench us through. Then if we lost our way, what should we do?"
Laura turned cold as stone to find her sister heard that cry alone, that goblin cry.
"Come buy our fruits, come buy."
Must she then buy no more such dainty fruit? Must she no more such succous pasture find, gone deaf and blind? Her tree of life drooped from the root. She said not one word in her heart's sore ache, but peering through the dimness, naught discerning, trudged home, her pitcher dripping all the way, so crept to bed and lay silent till Lizzie slept, then sat up in a passionate yearning and gnashed her teeth for balked desire and wept as if her heart would break. Day after day, night after night, Laura kept watch in vain, in sullen silence of exceeding pain. She never caught again the goblin cry,
"Come by, come by."
She never spied the goblin men hawking their fruits along the glen. But when the noon waxed bright, her hair grew thin and gray. She dwindled as the fair full moon doth turn to swift decay and burn her fire away. One day, remembering her kernel stone, she set it by a wall that faced the south, dewed it with tears, hoped for a root, watched for a waxing shoot. But there came none. It never saw the sun. It never felt the trickling moisture run. While with sunk eyes and faded mouth, she dreamed of melons as a traveler sees false waves in desert drouth, with shade of leaf-crowned trees, and burns the thirstier in the sandful breeze. She no more swept the house, tended the fowls or cows, fetched honey, kneaded cakes of wheat, brought water from the brook, but sat down listless in the chimney nook and would not eat. Tender Lizzie could not bear to watch her sister's cankerous care, yet not to share. She, night and morning, caught the goblin's cry,
"Come buy our orchard fruits, come buy, come buy."
Beside the brook, along the glen, she heard the tramp of the goblin men. The voice and stir poor Laura could not hear. Longed to buy fruit to comfort her, but feared to pay too dear. She thought of Jeannie in her grave, who should have been a bride, but who for joys brides hope to have fell sick and died in her gay prime in earliest winter time, with the first glazing rime, with the first snowfall of crisp winter time. Till Laura dwindling seemed knocking at death's door, then Lizzie weighed no more, better and worse, but put a silver penny in her purse, kissed Laura, crossed the heath with clumps of firs, at twilight halted by the brook, and for the first time in her life began to listen and look. Laughed every goblin when they spied her peeping, came towards her hobbling, flying, running, leaping, puffing and blowing, chuckling, clapping, crowing, clucking and gobbling, mopping and mowing, full of airs and graces, pulling wry faces, demure grimaces, cat-like and rat-like, ratel and wombat-like, snail-paced in a hurry, parrot-voiced and whistler, helter-skelter, hurry-scurry, chattering like magpies, fluttering like pigeons, gliding like fishes, hugged her and kissed her, squeezed her and caressed her, stretched up their dishes, panniers and plates.
"Look at our apples, russet and dun. Bob at our cherries, bite at our peaches, citrons and dates, grapes for the asking, pears red with basking. Out in the sun, plums on their twigs, pluck them and suck them, pomegranates, figs."
"Good folk,"
said Lizzie, mindful of Jeannie,
"give me much and many."
Held out her apron, tossed them her penny.
"Nay, take a seat with us, honor and eat with us,"
they answered, grinning.
"Our feast is but beginning. Night yet is early, warm and dew pearly. wakeful and starry. Such fruits as these no man can carry. Half their bloom would fly, half their dew would dry, half their flavor would pass by. Sit down and feast with us. Be welcome guest with us. Cheer you and rest with us.
Thank you,
said Lizzie.
But one waits at home alone for me. So without further parleying, if you will not sell me any of your fruits, though much and many, give me back my silver penny. I tossed you for a fee.
They began to scratch their pates, no longer wagging, purring, but visibly demurring. Grunting and snarling, one called her proud, cross-grained, uncivil. Their tones waxed loud, their looks were evil. Lashing their tails, they trod and hustled her, elbowed and jostled her, clawed with their nails, barking, mewing, hissing, mocking, tore her gown and soiled her stocking, twitched her hair out by the roots, stamped upon her tender feet, held her hands and squeezed their fruits against her mouth to make her eat. White and golden Lizzie stood like a lily in a flood, like a rock of blue-veined stone lashed by tides obstreperously, like a beacon left alone in a hoary, roaring sea, sending up a golden fire, like a fruit-crowned orange tree, white with blossoms honey-sweet, sore beset by wasp and bee, like a royal virgin town topped with gilded dome and spire, close beleaguered by a fleet mad to tug her standard down. One may lead a horse to water, 20 cannot make him drink. Though the goblins cuffed and caught her, coaxed and fought her, bullied and besought her, scratched her, pinched her black as ink, kicked and knocked her, mauled and mocked her, Lizzie uttered not a word, would not open lip from lip, lest they should cram a mouthful in, but laughed in heart to feel the drip of juice that syruped all her face, and lodged in dimples of her chin, and streaked her neck, which quaked like curd. At last the evil people, worn out by her resistance, flung back her penny, kicked their fruit along whichever road they took, not leaving root or stone or shoot. Some writhed into the ground, some dived into the brook, with ring and ripple, some scudded on the gale without a sound, some vanished in the distance. In a smart ache tingle, Lizzie went her way, knew not was it night or day, sprang up the bank, tore through the firs, threaded copse and dingle, and heard her penny jingle, bouncing in her purse. Its bounce was music to her ear. She ran and ran, as if she feared some goblin man dogged her with gibe or curse, or something worse. But not one goblin scurried after, nor was she pricked by fear. The kind heart made her windy paste, that urged her home quite out of breath with haste, and inward laughter. She cried,
Laura!
Up the garden.
Did you miss me? Come and kiss me. Never mind my bruises. Hug me, kiss me, suck my juices. Squeezed from goblin fruits for you. Goblin pulp and goblin dew. Eat me, drink me, love me. Laura, make much of me. For your sake I have braved the glen and had to do with goblin merchantmen.
Laura started from her chair, flung her arms up in the air, clutched her hair.
Lizzie, Lizzie, have you tasted for my sake the fruit forbidden? Must your light like mine be hidden? Your young life like mine be wasted, undone in mine undoing, and ruined in my ruin, thirsty, cankered, goblin-ridden?
She clung about her sister, kissed and kissed and kissed her. Tears once again refreshed her shrunken eyes, dropping like rain after long, sultry drouth. Shaking with anguish, fear, and pain, she kissed and kissed her with a hungry mouth. Her lips began to scorch. That juice was wormwood to her tongue. She loathed the feast. Writhing as one possessed, she leaped and sung, rent all her robe and wrung her hands in lamentable haste, and beat her breast. Her locks streamed like the torch borne by a racer at full speed, or like the mane of horses in their flight, or like an eagle when she stems the light straight toward the sun, or like a caged thing freed, or like a flying flag when armies run. Swift fire spread through her veins, knocked at her heart, met the fire smoldering there and overbore its lesser flame. She gorged on bitterness without a name, Ah, fool to choose such part of soul-consuming care. Sense failed in the mortal strife, like the watchtower of a town which an earthquake shatters down, like a lightning-stricken mast, like a wind-uprooted tree spun about, like a foam-topped waterspout. Cast down headlong in the sea, she fell at last. Pleasure passed and anguish passed. Is it death or is it life? Life out of death. That night long Lizzie watched by her, counted her pulse's flagging stir, felt for her breath, held water to her lips and cooled her face with tears and fanning leaves. But when the first birds chirped about their eaves and early reapers plodded to the place of golden sheaves and dew-wet grass bowed in the morning winds so brisk to pass, and new buds with new day opened of cup-like lilies on the stream, Laura awoke as from a dream, laughed in the innocent old way, hugged Lizzie, but not twice or thrice. Her gleaming locks showed not one thread of gray. Her breath was sweet as May, and light danced in her eyes. Days, weeks, months, years afterwards, when both were wives with children of their own, their mother hearts beset with fears, their lives bound up in tender lives, Laura would call the little ones and tell them of her early prime, those pleasant days long gone of not returning time. Would talk about the haunted glen, the wicked, quaint fruit merchant men, their fruits like honey to the throat, but poison in the blood. Men sell not such in any town. Would tell them how her sister stood in deadly peril to do her good and win the fiery antidote, then joining hands to little hands would bid them cling together.
For there is no friend like a sister in calm or stormy weather to cheer one on the tedious way, to fetch one if one goes astray, to lift one if one totters down, to strengthen whilst one stands.
We hope you enjoyed that reading, listeners, as much as we enjoyed doing it. We do have some discussion. We kind of sort of got to talking about this after I was going to say reenacted, but we did not do that.
No, goodness.
We just read it with voices.
That's what we did.
There's no reenacting involved.
No, goodness,
also,
no.
I guess this was a fantasy, so.
So you can't reenact something that never happened in the first place?
Yes. Anyway, we had some thoughts.
Yes.
And we are going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsor and then be right back with those. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. Now, back to past Annie, Lauren, Robert, and Joe, and our thoughts about the Goblin Market.
Yeah.
I get the feeling that the goblins represent men.
Oh, yes.
I would agree.
I think that might have something.
I think, yeah.
It's a very, it's.
This seems to offer like a, you don't need to go down to the goblins. What about sisterly love?
Right, yeah. Yeah, what about your family love? Come on. Yeah. What about saving yourself and getting married? That's clearly the best thing to do. Don't eat that goblin fruit.
Yeah.
No matter how tempting it is.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they'll call to you at night.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think I've seen, it reminds me of a lot of horror movies where women will fall in love with a monster. I've always found that an interesting trope.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I have a question.
Yeah?
Is Lizzie supposed to be Jesus?
See, that's a great question. Because the author, Christine Rossetti, maintains that there was no Christian allegory in it. But it is like a physical self-sacrifice.
Yeah, she like sacrifices her body and she comes back and then she says like, eat of me, drink of me, and love me or something.
Like, make much of me. Yeah.
Yeah, like I even read that. I caught myself like doing it how I would a prayer that you would say in church over and over again, like when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I like picked up that tone subconsciously. I didn't even think about it. So it had that for me. I was picking up on that.
Yeah.
The idea being that somebody has to fall to the goblins. Like somebody has to buy the goblin food. Because ultimately, somebody has to support the goblin economy. This is the driving force.
Yeah.
But also, Lizzie is presented as a sinless sacrifice. Like, she is morally pure. She doesn't have, like, the prurient interests that Laura does.
Yeah, the first time that she falls down into sin, first of all, she remains pure. She doesn't actually eat on purpose any of the fruit. And second of all, she only does it in order to save her sister.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sort of like coming down and into a sinful world. I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much. Yeah. So Rossetti says she didn't mean any of that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I can actually believe I can see it could be one of those things. So you live in Victorian culture. Maybe even if this is not you didn't mean it as an allegory for the New Testament or anything. Still, like, you're steeped in Christian religious themes.
Oh, yeah.
And so, like, if you want to write a story that's just a story about self-sacrifice and love, your main reference point is the existing archetype of the Christian story.
Absolutely. And she was a very religious woman. Mm-hmm. She was very active in her church. She a couple times turned down marriages because the Christian human dude in question wasn't the right type of Christian.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
Like can't truck with those Catholics.
Oh, I see.
Sort of thing.
Yeah. She had opinions.
She's a lady who had a lot of opinions. Yeah. Yes.
Well, this is a poem. I can detect opinions in between the lines in it. But man, it's funny how. So would you say that the tone of this poem is moralistic?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, personally, I can't help but find, like, a strong, more moralistic bent in it.
So, you know, that's interesting because I favor a very literal interpretation of the poem that goblins were literally selling fruit to ladies in Victorian times.
Well, you could. Well, yeah. I mean, of course they were, right?
Yeah, of course.
Also, it's interesting that you bring up the goblin economy because there has been some criticism about the poem that talks about the way that Laura is made into herself part of that economy, like the way that she pays for it is with a literal part of her
body.
With
the hair, yes.
Mm, yeah. And a tear.
And teardrops.
She pays for it with her body and with her suffering.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
Wait, did the goblins even ask for the tears?
No, they didn't ask her for anything.
They asked for the hair. That was only.
Oh, did they ask for the hair?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But that was after she said, well, I don't have any money. And they said, well, your hair is pretty golden. So
they're like, perfect.
Just what we wanted to hear.
See, we're in the wig business here. Yeah. Here at the goblin market.
Well, see, the upper class of goblin society, they're more into changelings. That's where the real money is.
Oh, you know?
But somebody's got to sell the fruit.
Yeah. If you don't have any babies on hand, then it's absolutely okay.
Well, I mean, what I was going to say was I think it's funny if you consider this poem moralistic. I get moralistic vibes from it as well. It seems like it's kind of like wagging a finger at I don't know, shameful, sinful curiosity.
Like indulgence.
Yeah, like telling you to be good. But at the same time, I feel like the poem is just kind of an orgy of words. It's like like she really gets into the nasty parts.
Like the sensuality, It's the way that those fruits are described is absolutely...
It's embarrassing.
Yeah.
I sort of realized after y'all agreed to do this, I was like, oh, man, I just asked my coworkers to do this. This is potentially inappropriate.
I have to say I really loved reading the Goblin Lines because there's kind of a I read a lot of Dr. Seuss these days, and so there's kind of like a Seussian element to it. But then so much of the narration, I feel like you could have dropped a beat behind it. Like it had some really tight rhymes.
Yeah. It really did.
Squeeze from goblin fruits for you, goblin juice and goblin dew.
Yeah, I think that was one of the parts where I was thinking, you know, you need to drop something in there. Maybe they can do that in post. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh man, yeah, Dylan, feel free to play around with it.
Turn it into a club hit.
Yeah, yeah, and then I don't know, like right up until because the both sisters get married at the end, but right up until then, it's the type of close physical relationship that I think is rebranded these days as being sexual, but at the time, among women and also among some men, especially younger men. It was allowable to have those kind of close physical relationships with another person of the same sex and even considered preferable to having a close physical relationship or a sexual relationship with someone of the opposite sex or gender.
Right.
But that being said, like in today's parlance, like that reads as just heck a lesbian.
Yes.
It It does, but I mean, knowing a little bit about literature at the time, I could see this is like straight up that kind of sisterly love kind of thing.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
They're like literally.
It's pure and innocent.
Yeah.
And it's just affectionate, and that's fine. Although, yeah, like, I don't know. Like, it's so interesting to me that the bad thing that Laura does is engage in this sensuality, in this like hedonistic indulgence. But the way that she's saved is by literally, physically kissing her sister's face. Her sin is with fruit, and her savior is with literal physical contact of another human person.
Hmm.
Victorians, y'all. I don't know. like I don't know what that means, but I'm just like, whoo, that's some kind of repression.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Like I was saying earlier, there's this trope where I feel like a lot of female characters that we see even today, when they fall in love, it's with some kind of monstrous creature. Like, I always think of Twilight. And I think it, hey, I think it represents, like, female fear of sexuality, having, like, a, being able to explore that. So it becomes this vampire or this werewolf that you're in love, but it's very dangerous.
And it's almost not your fault because you're kind of seduced by it, like Eve in the garden. Oh, which is another good religious allegory totally in there.
Yeah, eating the fruit. Yeah, the fruit is literally a sinful temptation.
Yeah.
But I mean, then again, we have versions of both the succubus and incubus in various cultures. Essentially the same idea. There's the monstrous masculine or the monstrous feminine that you have very little power to overcome.
Yeah.
That being said, I guess the goblins themselves don't sound very sexy, you know. They're, but their fruit is very
their
sexy.
Fruit
that
is
the thing.
Yes.
Well, I mean,
their call.
Then again, it's also very quite literally fruity. It's like it reads like maybe Rossetti was really hungry when she was writing this. Like she just gets into the fruit. I mean, there's that sexual implication, but there's also just totally like fruit. It's like, my God, that would taste good.
Yeah. And it's a little bit pastoral. She was writing. She didn't herself associate with the Pre-Raphaelite movement, but she was definitely associated with it. And like her brother was into it. And you can see a lot of the same influences, I think, in her work. That sort of like worship of the pastoral and even like a kind of Halicon version of what nature is and what nature has to present you, and those kind of medieval concepts of what it is to be a good person. A good person isn't living in the city. A good person is out in the country and doing these things and milking the cows and taking care of the poultry, and but somehow not being tempted by the best.
Well, the goblins are peddling like natural pleasures here, or at least, I mean, maybe they're not represented as such in the poem. But I mean, if we're to actually say what are fruit, fruit are the splendors of the natural world, right? No matter what other kind of symbolic power they end up taking on themselves.
But actually, they're not, aren't they? Are they? Because they're products of agriculture.
Well, yes, that's true. Especially the oranges.
Ooh. I mean, you go pick wild fruit, most of the time it's not very good.
There you go. Yeah. This is a warning against contemporary agribusiness.
Well, okay, but some of the fruit that the goblins are peddling here, I think, are more natural than the others.
I mean, those what are those, green gages?
Yeah.
Those are named after a dude. I just looked it up on Wikipedia. There's some guy named Gage.
Some guy named Gage out there. He's got a whole fruit named after him.
Heckin' Gage.
I wanted to say also that I just, on a purely technical level, I thought this is a really good poem. This is like really pleasurable to read line to line. It's got that, I really like the irregular rhyme scheme and the varying line length. It kind of reminds me of stuff like you would see in the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock later, you know, where like Eliot uses the irregular rhyme scheme and varying line length, but then sometimes it gets very regular all of a sudden.
Right.
And then when it does, that sort of like it like yanks you into the poem even deeper. It's it's good.
It's really beautiful.
Now here's a question. Do you think the goblins have a version of this poem that is warning impressionable young goblins not to sell fruit?
To Lizzie's?
To Lizzie's and Laura's?
No. I think it would say like, yeah, look, they did a good job with Laura, but they really screwed up with Lizzie.
It's true.
So here's the kind of Lizzie you need to watch out for.
Yeah.
Oh. What about Jeannie? The tragedy of Jeannie.
No, they did good with Jeannie,
yeah.
too.
Yeah, Jeannie and
she
Laura.
She died alone, unwed.
Yeah.
I mean,
that's the worst.
That in this time for a lady, yes.
These, like, dead women cautionary tales. It's just like, don't be like old dead Jeannie.
Yeah, no one wants to be like old dead Jeannie.
Yeah, but no, I like this idea of the goblins being like, oh, man. Watch out for those tight-lipped ones.
Yeah.
Though I guess you could say it's probably just goblin propaganda and goblins propping right. themselves up. I mean, that's ultimately one of the things that I think speaks well to 2018 readers of this poem or listeners to this poem is that there are, without a doubt, there are some goblin men in the world peddling their fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I do think it's interesting how often food is used to represent indulgence or like temptation. I guess because of things like the story of Eve in the Garden of Eden, like the apple is always popping up in things I'm reading is like, it's forbidden to partake in. The role of food in fairy tales is pretty fascinating.
Though, fun fact, you know, the Bible never says it's an apple.
That's right.
Never says what kind of fruit it is. And so there are all these arguments of religious scholars throughout the ages about what the fruit was. I think my favorite I've ever heard was that somebody said it was a lemon.
Don't eat that incredibly tempting lemon. I know you just want to eat it raw.
The whole thing.
Another fun fact, you know, the Bible never says it was the devil. It just says it's a snake.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
just a snake. Just a snake says, here's a fruit. It doesn't say what the fruit is. Doesn't say the snake's a devil.
Huh.
Yeah. We've talked a lot on the show about, like, people thought it was a banana. They think it's a fig. They thought it was... It's come up several times.
Most of the fruits, a pomegranate, most of the fruits that we've talked about, at some point, someone was like, probably that's what the Bible was talking about
right.
in the story.
It was a green Gage.
It was definitely.
Even though Gage wasn't around yet, he's just like a before his time. Some kind of time traveling going on there.
Well, no, it's Adam and Eve and Gage in the garden.
Oh, yeah. Almost forget about Gage.
Now, what I would love to see is to have some sort of like a fruit gummy tie-in to this poem where they're shaped like goblins, and each one, you have one for flavor for each of the fruits that are mentioned here.
I think we need to call Jelly Belly.
Yeah.
I think that's
Jelly Belly would be great at this.
Get them on the line.
Yeah.
Who's got their number?
Jelly Belly, if you're listening.
We're here and we've got ideas.
Or have a goblin market fruit juice establishment. I did notice when I initially looked up Goblin Market on my browser, the number one hit was a restaurant in Florida. So
ooh.
Called Goblin Market?
Yeah, Goblin Market. The Goblin Market, yeah.
Wow.
A sandwich shop.
They force food in your face?
I think it's just, like sexy goblins selling
grab your
sandwiches.
Hair, stomp on you and cram fruit in your mouth.
Yeah. Pinchy black.
That's what I want.
That's
yeah, it's figs to fill your mouth.
Goblin pulp and goblin juice.
And you can always find Robert and Joe on Stuff to Blow Your Mind, another How Stuff Works podcast.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Thanks. And occasionally we talk about foods and goblins as well. So
Yeah.
Yes, I'm getting that. I think everyone is getting that idea.
Well, thanks so much for inviting us on. We've had a great time.
Yeah, this is tremendous.
Well, that was fun.
Yes, absolutely.
It was fun. We would love to do it again, especially for Halloween. But if you listeners have suggestions, particularly helpful if they're in the public domain.
Oh, yes. Yes.
We're already kind of working on a second episode because we were collecting some and we were going to include more than one in this episode. But this one was... already like pretty hefty enough.
Yeah, it's so long that we didn't want to. Yeah, we could have gone on for another like hour at least, but we figured we'd just concentrate on this one for today.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many like Hans Christian Andersen stories that are great for that sort of thing.
Yeah. So please send in any suggestions you have for those. And speaking of sending things in,
it's time for
listener mail. Ooh.
All right.
Yeah. I was thinking about Robert's goblin voice, and then I was like, I can't do that. And that's the result was kind of a whispery wind.
It was. It was. It was either that or like a calm surf.
A calm surf
coming up to a beach.
Yeah, one of those things.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So our first letter is from Carly. Carly wrote, "I'm catching up on my podcast and just listened to your Willy Wonka episode. I have a story, although it doesn't involve food, other than the fact it was present in the building at the time. I had been invited to tag along at a house party of a local celebrity in Tourist Trap, USA, on the same weekend that a local comic convention was having a Willy Wonka reunion with various actors of the Gene Wilder film. Many of the famous guests were also in attendance of this party, although I was somewhat clueless. The host was a huge fan of many things and decorated his home extremely whimsically, as evidenced by his bathroom. One of the guests in attendance had been an Oompa Loompa with a few prominent lines, and when shown this bathroom, exclaimed in a very British accent, 'Oh, f-,' a sentiment felt by all. When the light switch was flipped on, the room filled with bubbles and the voice of Mr. Wilder singing Pure Imagination. The walls were covered in a Wonka-esque fruit motif wallpaper, and every fixture was adorned by brightly colored baubles and pom-poms. There were Willy Wonka accessories everywhere. I can't even begin to tell you what all was crammed into this previously normal, small, three-piece bathroom. It was wondrous."
Wow.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like quite the party.
It does. That sounds great.
I need to up my fantasy party game.
Apparently, yeah. I don't have Gene Wilder singing in any rooms of my house. What? Not automatically, anyway.
What are we even doing, Lauren?
I know. Oh, I'm rethinking a number of things is what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
John, or Sergeant Mac, wrote, "Having lived in Virginia most of my life and experiencing many hurricanes, I find that peanut butter and jelly sandwiches are the unsung heroes of emergency foods. Everyone has the makings in their home. They can be bought almost anywhere, including gas stations. They are filling and kind of nourishing. The ingredients are portable and need no refrigeration nor water, and anyone can make them. When you're back at work after 6 days without power, that is what the people are eating. All hail peanut butter."
All hail peanut butter, indeed.
All hail.
All hail. If I were to succumb to a cult, I'm sure peanut butter would be involved.
Oh, my goodness. It certainly would. Not that I'm planning that. But, you know, yeah. Now that you mention it,
yeah,
it's a great plan.
It's just like a dummy made of peanut butter jars. I'm giving you ideas. Why am I doing this?
I don't know.
Oh, geez.
I couldn't tell you.
All right. Well, thanks to both of them for writing in. You too can write us. Our email is foodstuff@howstuffworks.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Foodstuff HSW, stands for How Stuff Works, or on Instagram at Foodstuff. We do hope to hear from you. Thank you, as always, to our super producer, Dylan K. Fagan, who extra super produced this episode, all of that wonderful thematic stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Noise stuff. Audio stuff. Emotions. That's
yes,
him.
That was him.
That was him. Thank you, Dylan. Thanks to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.